Death pushed his chair back and stalked confidently towards the nearest wall. Ouch. Keeble watched expectantly.
Go on, then, he said.
This is an ordinary wall, is it?
I assume so. I'm not an expert.
It seems to be presenting me with some difficulty.
So it would appear.
What do you call the feeling of being very small and hot?
Keeble twiddled his pencil.
Pygmy?
Begins with an M.
Embarrassing?
Yes, said Death. I mean, yes.
It would seem that you have no useful skill or talent whatsoever, he said. Have you thought of going into teaching?
Death's face was a mask of terror. Well, it was always a mask of terror, but this time he meant it to be.
You see, said Keeble kindly, putting down his pen and steepling his hands together, it's very seldom I ever have to find a new career for an, what was it again?
Anthropomorphic personification.
Oh, yes. Well, what is that exactly?
Death had had enough.
This, he said.
For a moment, just for a moment, Mr. Keeble saw him clearly. His face went nearly as pale as Death's own. His hands jerked convulsively. His heart gave a stutter. Death watched him with mild interest, then drew an hourglass from the depths of his robe and held it up to the light and examined it critically.
Settle down, he said. You've got a good few years yet. I could tell you how many, if you like.
Keeble, fighting to breathe, managed to shake his head.
Do you want me to get you a glass of water, then?
The shop bell jangled. Keeble's eyes rolled. Death decided that he owed the man something. He shouldn't be allowed to lose custom, which was clearly something humans valued dearly. He pushed aside the bead curtain and stalked into the outer shop, where a small fat woman, looking rather like an angry cottage loaf, was hammering on the counter with a haddock.
"It's about that kook's job up at the university,"
she said.
"You told me it was a good position, and it's a disgrace up there. The tricks them students play, and I demand. I want you to... I am not..."
Her voice trailed off.
"Here,"
she said, but you could tell her heart wasn't in it.
"You are not Keeble, are you?"
Death stared at her. He'd never before experienced an unsatisfied customer. He was at a loss. Finally, he gave up.
"Begone, you black and midnight hag," he said.
The cook's small eyes narrowed.
"Who are you calling a midnight bag?"
she said accusingly, and hit the counter with the fish again.
"Look at this," she said. "Last night it was my bed warmer. In the morning it's a fish. I ask you."
"May all the demons of hell rend your living spirit if you don't get out of the shop this minute,"
Death tried.
"I don't know about that, but what about my bed warmer? It's no place for a respectable woman up there. They tried to..."
"If you would care to go away," said Death desperately, "I will give you some money."
"How much?"
said the cook, with a speed that would have outdistanced the striking rattlesnake and given lightning a nasty shock. Death pulled out his coin bag and tipped a heap of verdigrised and darkened coins on the counter. She regarded them with deep suspicion.
"Now, leave upon the instant," said Death, and added, "before the searing winds of infinity scorch thy worthless carcass."
"My husband will be told about this,"
said the cook darkly as she left the shop. It seemed to Death that no threat of his could possibly be as dire. He stalked back through the curtains. Keeble, still slumped in his chair, gave a kind of strangled gurgle.
"It was true," he said. "I thought you were a nightmare."
"I could take offence at that," said Death.
"You really are Death?" said Keeble.
"Yes."
"Why didn't you say?"
"People usually prefer me not to."
Keeble scrabbled among his papers, giggling hysterically.
"You want to do something else?" he said. "Tooth fairy? Water sprite? Sandman?"
"Do not be foolish. I simply feel I want a change."
Keeble's frantic rustling at last turned up the paper he'd been searching for. He gave a maniacal laugh and thrust it into Death's hands. Death read it.
"This is a job? People are paid to do this?"
"Yes, yes. Go and see him. You're just the right type. Only, don't tell him I sent you."
Binky moved at a hard gallop across the night, the disc unrolling far below his hooves.
Now Mort found that the sword could reach out further than he had thought. It could reach the stars themselves, and he swung it across the deeps of space and into the heart of a yellow dwarf which went nova most satisfactorily. He stood in the saddle and whirled the blade around his head, laughing as the blue flame fanned across the sky, leaving a trail of darkness and embers. And didn't stop. Mort struggled as the sword cut through the horizon, grinding down the mountains, drying up the seas, turning green forests into punk and ashes. He heard voices behind him, and the brief screams of friends and relatives as he turned desperately. Dust storms whirled from the dead earth as he fought to release his own grip, but the sword burned icy cold in his hand, dragging him on in a dance that would not end until there was nothing left alive. And that time came, and Mort stood alone except for Death, who said, "A fine job, boy." And Mort said, "Mort!
Mort, Mort, wake up."
Mort surfaced slowly like a corpse in a pond. He fought against it, clinging to his pillow and the horrors of sleep, but someone was tugging urgently at his ear.
"Hmm?"
he said.
"Mort!
What is it?
Mort!
It's Father!"
He opened his eyes and stared up blankly into Isabel's face. Then the events of the previous night hit him like a sock full of damp sand. Mort swung his legs out of bed, still wreathed in the remains of his dream.
"Yeah, okay," he said. "I'll go see him directly."
"He's not here. Albert's going crazy." Isabel stood by the bed, tugging a handkerchief between her hands. "Mort, do you think something has happened to him?" He gave her a blank look.
"Don't be bloody stupid," he said. "He's deaf."
He scratched his skin. He felt hot and dry and itchy.
"But he's never been away this long, not even when there was that big plague in Pseudopolis. I mean, he has to be here in the mornings to do the books and work out the nodes and..."
Mort grabbed her arms.
"All right, all right,"
he said, as soothingly as he could manage. "I'm sure everything's okay. Just settle down, I'll go and check.
Why have you got your eyes shut?"
"Mort, please put some clothes on," said Isabel in a tight little voice. Mort looked down.
"Sorry," he said meekly. "I didn't realise. Who put me to bed?"
"I did," she said. "But I looked the other way." Mort dragged on his breeches, shrugged into his shirt, and hurried out towards Death's study with Isabel on his heels. Albert was in there, jumping from foot to foot like a duck on a griddle. When Mort came in, the look on the old man's face could almost have been gratitude. Mort saw with amazement that there were tears in his eyes.
"His chair hasn't been sat in,"
Albert whined.
"Sorry, but is that important?" said Mort. "My grandad didn't used to come home for days if he'd had a good sale at the market."
"But he's always here," said Albert. "Every morning, as long as I've known him, sitting here at his desk, working on the nodes. It's his job. He wouldn't miss it."
"I expect the nodes can look after themselves for a day or two," said Mort.
The drop in temperature told him he was wrong. He looked at their faces.
"They can't," he said.
Both heads shook.
"If the nodes aren't worked out properly, all the balance is destroyed," said Isabel. "Anything could happen."
"Didn't he explain?" said Albert.
"Not really. I've really only done the practical side. He said he'd tell me about the theoretical stuff later," said Mort.
Isabel burst into tears. Albert took Mort's arm, and with considerable dramatic waggling of his eyebrows, indicated that they should have a little talk in the corner. Mort trailed after him reluctantly. The old man rummaged in his pockets and at last produced a battered paper bag.
"Peppermint?"
he inquired. Mort shook his head.
"He never tell you about the nodes," said Albert.
Mort shook his head again. Albert gave his peppermint a suck. It sounded like the plug hole in the bath of God.
"How old are you, lad?"
"Mort, I'm 16.
"There's some things a lad ought to be told before he's 16,
said Albert, looking over his shoulder at Isabel, who was sobbing in Death's chair.
"Oh, I know about that. My father told me all about that when he used to take the Thargas to be mated. When a man and a woman..."
"About the universe is what I meant," said Albert hurriedly. "I mean, have you ever thought about it?
I know the disk is carried through space on the backs of four elephants that stand on the shell of Great Artuin," said Mort.
"That's just part of it. I meant the whole universe of time and space and life and death and day and night and everything."
"Can't say I've ever given it much thought," said Mort.
"Ah, you ought. The point is, the nodes are part of it. They stop death from getting out of control, see? Not him, not death, just death itself,
Albert struggled for words. Like death should come exactly at the end of life, you see, and not before or after, and the nodes have to be worked out so that the key figures... You're not taking this in, are you? Sorry? They've got to be worked out, said Albert flatly, and then the correct lives have got to be got. The hourglasses, you call them. The actual duty is the easy job. Can you do it? No. Can you? No. Albert sucked reflectively at his peppermint. That's the whole world in a gippo, then, he said. Look, I can't see why you're so worried. I expect he's just got held up somewhere, said Mort, but it sounded feeble even to him. It wasn't as though people buttonholed Death to tell him another story, or clapped him on the back and said things like, "You've got time for a quick half in there, me old mate, no need to rush off home," or invited him to make up a skittles team and come out for a Clatchian takeaway afterwards, or... It struck Mort with sudden, terrible poignancy that Death must be the loneliest creature in the universe. In the great party of creation, he was always in the kitchen. "I'm sure I don't know what's come over the master lately," mumbled Albert. "Out of the chair, my girl, let's have a look at these nodes." They opened the ledger. They looked at it for a long time. Then Mort said, "What do all these symbols mean?" "Sodomy non sapiens," said Albert under his breath. "What does that mean?" "Means I'm buggered if I know." "That was wizard talk, wasn't it?" said Mort. "You shut up about wizard talk. I don't know anything about wizard talk. You apply your brain to this here." Mort looked down again at the tracery of lines. It was as if a spider had spun a web on the page, stopping at every junction to make notes. Mort stared until his eyes hurt, waiting for some spark of inspiration. None volunteered. "Any luck?"
"It's all Clatchian to me," said Mort. "I don't even know whether it should be read upside down or sideways."
"Spiralling from the centre outwards," sniffed Isabel from her seat in the corner. Their heads collided as they both peered at the centre of the page. They stared at her. She shrugged. "Father taught me how to read the node chart," she said, "when I used to do my sewing in here. He used to read bits out."
"You can help," said Mort.
"No," said Isabel. She blew her nose.
"What do you mean, no?" growled Albert. "This is too important for any flighty..."
"I mean," said Isabel in razor tones, "that I can do them, and you can help." The Ankh-Morpork Guild of Merchants has taken to hiring large gangs of men with ears like fists and fists like large bags of walnuts, whose job it is to re-educate those misguided people who publicly fail to recognise the many attractive points of their fine city. For example, the philosopher Catroaster was found floating face down in the river within hours of uttering the famous line, "When a man is tired of Ankh-Morpork, he is tired of ankle-deep slurry." Therefore, it is prudent to dwell on one, of the very many, of course, on one of the things that makes Ankh-Morpork renowned among the great cities of the multiverse. This is its food. The trade routes of half the disk pass through the city or down its rather sluggish river. More than half the tribes and races of the disk have representatives dwelling within its sprawling acres. In Ankh-Morpork, the cuisines of the world collide. On the menu are 1,000 types of vegetable, 1,500 cheeses, 2,000 spices, 300 types of meat, 200 fowl, 500 different kinds of fish, 100 variations on the theme of pasta, 70 eggs of one kind or another, 50 insects, 30 mollusks, 20 assorted snakes and other reptiles, and something pale brown and warty known as the Clatchian migratory bog truffle. Its eating establishments range from the opulent, where the portions are tiny but the plates are silver, to the secretive, where some of the disk's more exotic inhabitants are rumoured to eat anything they can get down their throat best out of three. Harger's House of Ribs, down by the docks, is probably not numbered among the city's leading eateries, catering as it does for the type of beefy clientele that prefers quantity and breaks up the tables if it doesn't get it. They don't go in for the fancy or exotic, but stick to conventional food like flightless bird embryos, minced organs in intestine skins, slices of hog flesh and burnt ground grass seeds dipped in animal fats. Or, as it is known in their patois, egg, sauce and bacon and a fried slice. It was the kind of eating house that didn't need a menu. You just looked at Harger's vest. Still, he had to admit, this new cook seemed to be the business. Harger, an expansive advert for his own high-carbohydrate merchandise, beamed at a room full of satisfied customers. And a fast worker, too. In fact, disconcertingly fast. He rapped on the hatch.
"Double egg, chips, beans and a troll burger, hold the onions," he rasped.
"Right."
The hatch slid up a few seconds later, and two plates were pushed through. Hager shook his head in gratified amazement. It had been like that all evening. The eggs were bright and shiny, the beans glistened like rubies, and the chips were the crisp golden brown of sunburned bodies on expensive beaches. Hager's last cook had turned out chips like little paper bags full of pus. Hager looked around the steamy cafe. No one was watching him. He was going to get to the bottom of this. He rapped on the hatch again.
"Alligator sandwich," he said, "and make it snappy."
The hatch shot up. After a few seconds to pluck up enough courage, Hager peered under the top slice of the long sarnie in front of him. He wasn't saying that it was alligator, and he wasn't saying it wasn't. He knuckled the hatch again.
"Okay," he said. "I'm not complaining. I just want to know how you did it so fast."
"Time is not important."
"You say."
"Right."
Hager decided not to argue.
"Well, you're doing a damn fine job in there, boy," he said.
"What is it called when you feel warm and content and wish things would stay that way?"
"I guess you'd call it happiness," said Hager.
Inside the tiny cramped kitchen, strattered with the grease of decades, Death spun and whirled, chopping, slicing and flying. His skillet flashed through the fetid steam. He'd opened the door to the cold night air, and a dozen neighbourhood cats had strolled in, attracted by the bowls of milk and meat, some of Hager's best, if he'd known, that had been strategically placed around the floor. Occasionally Death would pause in his work and scratch one of them behind the ears.
"Happiness," he said,
and puzzled at the sound of his own voice. Cutwell, the wizard and royal recogniser by appointment, pulled himself up the last of the tower steps and leaned against the wall, waiting for his heart to stop thumping. Actually, it wasn't particularly high, this tower, just high for Stow Lutt. In general design and outline, really high, this tower, just high for Stow Lutt. In general design and outline, it looked the standard sort of tower for imprisoning princesses in. It was mainly used to store old furniture. However, it offered unsurpassed views of the city and the Stow Plain, which is to say, you could see an awful lot of cabbages. Cutwell made it as far as the crumbling crenellations atop the wall and looked out at the morning haze. It was maybe a little hazier than usual. If he tried hard, he could imagine a flicker in the sky. If he really strained his imagination, he could hear a buzzing out over the cabbage fields, a sound like someone frying locusts. He shivered. At a time like this, his hands automatically patted his pockets and found nothing at all but half a bag of jelly babies melted into a sticky mass and an apple core. Neither offered much consolation. What Cutwell wanted was what any normal wizard wanted at a time like this, which was a smoke. He'd have killed for a cigar and would have gone as far as a flesh wound for a squashed dog end. He pulled himself together. Resolution was good for the moral fibre. The only trouble was the fibre didn't appreciate the sacrifices he was making for it. They said that a truly great wizard should be permanently under tension. You could have used Cutwell for a bowstring. He turned his back on the brassicaed landscape and made his way back down the winding steps to the main part of the palace. Still, he told himself, the campaign appeared to be working. The population didn't seem to be resisting the fact that there was going to be a coronation, although they weren't exactly clear about who was going to be crowned. There was going to be bunting in the streets, and Cutwell had arranged for the town square's main fountain to run, if not with wine, then at least with an acceptable beer made from broccoli. There was going to be folk dancing, at sword point if necessary. There would be races for children. There would be an ox roast. The royal coach had been regilded, and Cutwell was optimistic that people could be persuaded to notice it as it went by. The high priest at the Temple of Blind Io was going to be a problem. Cutwell had marked him down as a dear old soul whose expertise with the knife was so unreliable that half of the sacrifices got tired of waiting and wandered away. The last time he'd tried to sacrifice a goat, it had time to give birth to twins before he could focus, and then the courage of motherhood had resulted in it chasing the entire priesthood out of the temple. The chances of him succeeding in putting the crown on the right person, even in normal circumstances, were only average, Cutwell had calculated. He'd have to stand alongside the old boy and try tactfully to guide his shaking hands. Still, even that wasn't the big problem. The big problem was much bigger than that. The big problem had been sprung on him by the Chancellor after breakfast.
"Fireworks," Cutwell had said.
"That's the sort of thing you wizard fellows are supposed to be good at, isn't it?" said the Chancellor, as crusty as a week-old loaf. "Flashes and bangs and what not. I remember a wizard when I was a lad. I'm afraid I don't know anything about prince. Lots of rockets,
the Chancellor reminisced happily.
"Archean candles, thunder flashes, and thingies that you can hold in your hand. It's not a proper coronation without fireworks."
"Yes, but you see..." "Good man," said the Chancellor briskly. "Knew we could rely on you. Plenty of rockets, you understand, and to finish with there must be a set piece, mind you. Something really breathtaking, like a portrait of... His eyes glazed over in a way that was becoming depressingly familiar to Cutwell. "The Princess Kaylee," he said wearily.
"Ah, yes, her," said the Chancellor. "A portrait of, who you said, in fireworks. Of course, it's probably all pretty simple stuff to you wizards, but the people like it. Nothing like a good blowout and a blow-up and a bit of a balcony waving to keep the loyalty muscles in tip-top shape. That's what I always say. See to it. Rockets. With runes on."
An hour ago, Cutwell had thumbed through the index of the Monster Fun Grimoire and had cautiously assembled a number of common household ingredients and put a match to them. "Funny thing about eyebrows," he mused. "You never really noticed them until they'd gone." Red around the eyes and smelling slightly of smoke, Cutwell ambled towards the royal apartments, past bevies of maids engaged in whatever it was maids did, which always seemed to take at least three of them. Whenever they saw Cutwell, they would usually go silent, hurry past with their heads down, and break into muffled giggles along the corridor. This annoyed Cutwell. Not, he told himself quickly, because of any personal considerations, but because wizards ought to be shown more respect. Besides, some of the maids had a way of looking at him which caused him to think distinctly unwizardly thoughts. Truly, he thought, the way of enlightenment is like unto half a mile of broken glass. He knocked on the door of Kaylee's suite. A maid opened it.
"Is your mistress in?" he said, as haughtily as he could manage.
The maid put her hand to her mouth. Her shoulders shook. Her eyes sparkled. A sound like escaping steam crept between her fingers.
"I can't help it," Cutwell thought. "I just seem to have this amazing effect on women."
"Is it a man?"
came Kaylee's voice from within. The maid's eyes glazed over, and she tilted her head, as if not sure of what she had heard.
"It's me, Cutwell," said Cutwell.
"Oh, that's all right, then. You can come in."
Cutwell pushed past the girl and tried to ignore the muffled laughter as the maid fled the room. Of course, everyone knew a wizard didn't need a chaperone. It was just the tone of the princess's, "Oh, that's all right, then," that made him writhe inside. Kaylee was sitting at her dressing table, brushing her hair. Very few men in the world ever find out what a princess wears under her dresses, and Cutwell joined them with extreme reluctance, but with remarkable self-control. Only the frantic bobbing of his Adam's apple betrayed him. There was no doubt about it. He'd been no good for magic for days. She turned, and he caught a whiff of talcum powder. For weeks, damn it, for weeks. "You look a bit hot, Cutwell. Is something the matter?"
"No."
"I'm sorry?" He shook himself.
"Concentrate on the hairbrush, man, the hairbrush.
Just a bit of magical experimenting, ma'am. Only superficial burns."
"Is it still moving?"
"I'm afraid so."
Kaylee turned back to the mirror. Her face was set.
"Have we got time?"
This was the bit he'd been dreading. He'd done everything he could. The royal astrologer had been sobered up long enough to insist that tomorrow was the only possible day the ceremony could take place, so Cutwell had arranged for it to begin 1 second after midnight. He'd ruthlessly cut the score of the royal trumpet fanfare. He'd timed the high priest's invocation to the gods, and then sub-edited heavily. There was going to be a row when the gods found out. The ceremony of the anointing with sacred oils had been cut to a quick dab behind the ears. Skateboards were an unknown invention on the disc. If they hadn't been, Kaylee's trip up the aisle would have been unconstitutionally fast. And it still wasn't enough. He nerved himself.
"I think possibly not," he said. "It could be a very close thing."
He saw her glare at him in the mirror.
"How close?"
Very.
"Are you trying to say it might reach us at the same time as the ceremony?"
More sort of, well, before it,"
said Cutwell wretchedly. There was no sound but the drumming of Kaylee's fingers on the edge of the table. Cutwell wondered if she was going to break down or smash the mirror. Instead, she said,
"How do you know?"
He wondered if he could get away with saying something like, "I'm a wizard, we know these things," but decided against it. The last time he'd said that, she threatened him with the axe. "I asked one of the guards about that inn Mort talked about," he said. "Then I worked out the approximate distance it had to travel. Mort said it was moving at a slow walking pace, and I reckon his stride is about..."
"As simple as that? You didn't use magic?"
"Only common sense. A lot more reliable in the long run."
She reached out and patted his hand. "Poor old Cutwell," she said. "I am only 20, ma'am." She stood up and walked over to the dressing room. One of the things you learn when you're a princess is always to be older than anyone of inferior rank. "Yes, I suppose there must be such things as young wizards," she said over her shoulder. "It's just that people always think of them as old. I wonder why this is."
"Rigors of the calling, ma'am," said Cutwell, rolling his eyes. He could hear the rustle of silk.
"What made you decide to become a wizard?" Her voice was muffled, as if she had something over her head.
"It's indoor work with no heavy lifting," said Cutwell. "And I suppose I wanted to learn how the world worked."
"Have you succeeded, then?"
"No."
Cutwell wasn't much good at small talk. Otherwise he'd never have let his mind wander sufficiently to allow him to say,
"What made you decide to become a princess?"
After a thoughtful silence, she said, "It was decided for me, you know. Sorry, I... Being royal is a sort of family tradition. I expect it's the same with magic. No doubt your father was a wizard."
Cutwell gritted his teeth. No, he said. "Not really. Absolutely not, in fact." He knew what she would say next, and here it came, reliable as the sunset, in a voice tinged with amusement and fascination.
"Oh, is it really true that wizards aren't allowed to..."
"Well, if that's all, I really should be going," said Cutwell loudly. "If anyone wants me, just follow the explosions. I..."
Kaylee had stepped out of the dressing room. Now, women's clothes were not a subject that preoccupied Cutwell much. In fact, usually when he thought about women, his mental picture seldom included any clothes at all. But the vision in front of him really did take his breath away. Whoever had designed the dress didn't know when to stop. They'd put lace over the silk and trimmed it with black vermin, and strung pearls anywhere that looked bare, and puffed and starched the sleeves, and then added silver filigree, and then started again with the silk. In fact, it really was amazing what could be done with several ounces of heavy metal, some irridated mollusks, a few dead rodents, and a lot of thread wound out of insects' bottoms. The dress wasn't so much worn as occupied. If the outlying flounces weren't supported on wheels, then Kaylee was stronger than he'd given her credit for. "What do you think?" she said, turning slowly. "This was worn by my mother, and my grandmother, and her mother."
"What, all together?" said Cutwell, quite prepared to believe it.
"How can she get into it?" he wondered. "There must be a door round the back." "It's a family heirloom. It's got real diamonds on the bodice."
"Which bit's the bodice?"
"This bit." Cutwell shuddered.
"It's very impressive," he said, when he could trust himself to speak. "You don't think it's perhaps a bit mature, though?"
"It's queenly."
"Yes, but perhaps it won't allow you to move very fast."
"I have no intention of running. There must be dignity." Once again the set of her jaw traced the line of her descent all the way to her conquering ancestor, who preferred to move very fast at all times, and knew as much about dignity as could be carried on the point of a sharp spear. Cutwell spread his hands.
"All right," he said. "Fine. We all do what we can. I just hope Mort has come up with some ideas."
"It's hard to have confidence in a ghost," said Kaylee. "He walks through walls."
"I've been thinking about that," said Cutwell. "It's a puzzle, isn't it? He walks through things only if he doesn't know he's doing it. I think it's an industrial disease."
"What?"
"I was nearly sure last night. He's becoming real."
"But we're all real. At least you are, and I suppose I am. But he's becoming more real, extremely real, nearly as real as death. And you don't get much realer. Not much realer at all."
"Are you sure?" said Albert, suspiciously.
"Of course," said Isabel. "Work it out yourself, if you like." Albert looked back at the big book, his face a portrait of uncertainty.
"Well, they could be about right,"
he conceded with bad grace, and copied out the two names on a scrap of paper.
"There's one way to find out, anyway."
He pulled open the top drawer of Death's desk and extracted a big iron key ring. There was only one key on it.
"What happens now?" said Mort.
"We've got to fetch the lifetimers," said Albert. "You have to come with me."
"Mort!"
hissed Isabel.
"What?"
"What you just said."
She lapsed into silence and then added,
"Oh, nothing. It just sounded odd."
"I only asked what happens now," said Mort.
"Yes, but you..." "Oh, never mind."
Albert brushed past them and sidled out into the hallway like a two-legged spider until he reached the door that was always kept locked. The key fitted perfectly. The door swung open. There wasn't so much as a squeak from its hinges, just a swish of deeper silence. And the roar of sand. Mort and Isabel stood in the doorway, transfixed, as Albert stamped off between the aisles of glass. The sound didn't just enter the body via the ears, it came up through the legs and down through the skull, and filled up the brain until all that it could think of was the rushing, hissing, grey noise, the sound of millions of lives being lived, and rushing towards their inevitable destination. They stared up and out at the endless ranks of lifetimers. Everyone different, everyone named. The light from torches ranged along the walls, picked highlights off them, so that a star gleamed on every glass. The far walls of the room were lost in a galaxy of light. Mort felt Isabel's fingers tighten on his arm. When she spoke, her voice was strained.
Mort, some of them are so small.
I know.
Her grip relaxed very gently, like someone putting the top ace on a house of cards, and taking their hand away gingerly so as not to bring the whole edifice down.
Say that again,
she said quietly.
I said I know. There's nothing I can do about it. Haven't you been in here before?
No. She had withdrawn slightly and was staring at his eyes.
It's no worse than the library, said Mort, and almost believed it.
But in the library you only read about it. In here you could see it happening.
Why are you looking at me like that?
He added.
I was just trying to remember what colour your eyes were, she said, because...
If you two have had quite enough of each other, bellowed Albert above the roar of sand, this way.
Brown, said Mort to Isabel. They're brown. Why?
Hurry up.
You'd better go and help him, said Isabel. He seems to be getting quite upset. Mort left her, his mind a sudden swamp of uneasiness, and stalked across the tiled floor to where Albert stood impatiently tapping a foot.
What do I have to do? He said.
Just follow me.
The room opened out into a series of passages, each one lined with the hourglasses. Here and there the shelves were divided by stone pillars, inscribed with angular markings. Albert glanced at them occasionally. Mainly he strode through the maze of sand, as though he knew every turn by heart.
Is there one glass for everyone, Albert?
Yes.
This place doesn't look big enough.
Do you know anything about M-dimensional topography?
No.
Then I shouldn't aspire to hold any opinions if I was you, said Albert.
He paused in front of a shelf of glasses, glanced at the paper again, ran his hand along the row, and suddenly snatched up a glass. The top bulb was almost empty.
Hold this, he said. If this is right, then the other should be somewhere near. Ah, here.
Mort turned the two glasses around in his hand. One had all the markings of an important life, while the other one was squat and quite unremarkable. Mort read the names. The first seemed to refer to a nobleman in the Agatian Empire regions. The second was a collection of pictograms that he recognized as originating in Turnwise Clatch.
Over to you, Albert sneered. The sooner you get started, the sooner you'll be finished. I'll bring Binky round to the front door.
Do my eyes look all right to you?
Said Mort anxiously.
Nothing wrong with them that I can see, said Albert.